Chapter 8. After the election, President Obama directed his intelligence chiefs to produce a definitive, highly classified report on Russian election interference with all the sources and details. It would be briefed to the Gang of Eight in Congress and to President-elect Trump. An unclassified, scaled-back version with the same conclusions but without identifying the sources would be made public before Obama left office on January 20th. Director of National Intelligence James Clapper, CIA Director John Brennan, FBI Director James Comey, and National Security Agency Director Mike Rogers met to work on talking points for the briefing to Trump. They knew he would see the report as challenging his win, casting doubt on the legitimacy of his election. They agreed they would have to speak with one voice. "This is our story and we're sticking to it," Clapper said, encouraging solidarity. Clapper would be the main briefer. It was essential they speak with confidence. Clearly, the briefing was going to stir the beast. Earlier in December, Brennan had called Clapper. He had received a copy of a 35-page dossier, a series of reports from former British MI6 senior officer Christopher Steele that detailed alleged efforts by Russia to interfere with and influence the presidential election, to cause chaos, damage Hillary Clinton, and help Trump. The dossier also contained salacious claims about Trump, Russian prostitutes, and golden showers. "You should read this," Brennan told Clapper. The FBI already had a top-secret counterintelligence investigation underway to see if there was any collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia. "This will add substantiation to what we are doing." It was not proof, but it seemed to be on the same trail. Clapper consulted with the FBI. How should we handle it with Trump? The FBI was familiar with the document. Steele had shared portions of the dossier with them, and on December 9th, Senator John McCain had shared a copy with FBI Director Comey. Andrew McCabe, the FBI deputy, was concerned. He thought if they failed to tell President-elect Trump about the dossier when they briefed him about the intelligence community report on Russia, it would make the FBI look as if they were back in the old days of J. Edgar Hoover, as if to say, "We have dirt on people and we're keeping it to ourselves." Comey agreed. The Hoover legacy still cast a shadow over the Bureau. Clapper wanted to make sure they developed a consistent tradecraft model as they merged their intelligence into one report. The FBI and CIA have different standards. The FBI conducts criminal investigations in addition to gathering intelligence. The Bureau tends to be more rigorous in their sourcing and verification. What began as a pure counterintelligence investigation might morph into a criminal investigation, with intelligence becoming evidence that must stand up in court. The CIA's mission is to gather intelligence and disseminate it to the White House and the rest of the federal government. It does not have to be as solid because normally it would not be used in a criminal trial. Just as the FBI was haunted by Hoover, the CIA had its own ghost. In the run-up to the 2003 invasion of Iraq, the CIA made a huge mistake. In part as a result of lies told by a key source, amazingly codenamed Curveball, who claimed he had worked in a mobile chemical weapons lab in Iraq, the CIA had concluded that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction, WMD. The case had been a slam dunk, according to a presentation CIA Director George Tenet made to President George W. Bush. The alleged presence of WMD was the key justification for the Iraq invasion. No WMD were found, an acute embarrassment for the president and the CIA. Clapper knew that mistake hung over much of what the CIA did and analyzed. One agency procedure was to polygraph sources as often as possible. While passing a lie detector test would never be considered complete proof, passing was a good barometer of truthfulness. The sources that Steele used for his dossier had not been polygraphed, which made their information uncorroborated and potentially suspect. But Brennan said the information was in line with their own sources, in which he had great confidence. The dossier was in circulation among journalists, and Steele had given confidential, off-the-record interviews to reporters. It had not yet been published. On the second page, it said, according to source D, where she slash he had been present, Trump's perverted conduct in Moscow included hiring the presidential suite of the Ritz-Carlton Hotel, where he knew President and Mrs. Obama, whom he hated, had stayed on one of their official trips to Russia, and defiling the bed where they had slept by employing a number of prostitutes to perform a golden showers urination show in front of him. The hotel was known to be under FSB control, with microphones and concealed cameras in all the main rooms to record anything they wanted to. This was designed to obtain compromat, compromising material, on him, according to the dossier. It was a spectacular allegation. There was no available indication who Source D might be. Since the FBI had the dossier, Comey said, he ought to present it to Trump after their core presentation of the intelligence community assessment. It would be an annex, virtually a footnote. The 35 pages were reduced to a 1 3/4 page summary that focused on the allegation of coordination between the Russians and the campaign. Trump's response to the growing chorus of news reports saying that the intelligence services had concluded Russia had interfered with the election was belligerence. On December 9th, Trump said those sounding alarm in the intelligence community were the same people that said Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. He later told Fox News, they have no idea if it's Russia or China or somebody sitting in a bed someplace. He tweeted, unless you catch hackers in the act, it is very hard to determine who was doing the hacking. Why wasn't this brought up before the election? On January 5th, the Senate Armed Services Committee held a hearing on Russian hacking. Clapper, who was to brief Trump the next day, testified. Angry at the criticism Trump was leveling at the intelligence community, he stated, there's a difference between skepticism and disparagement. Public trust and confidence in the intelligence community is crucial, and I've received many expressions of concern from foreign counterparts about the disparagement of the U.S. intelligence community. The next day, Kellyanne Conway said on CBS This Morning, why would Russia want Donald Trump to win the presidency here? Donald Trump has promised to modernize our nuclear capability. In a telephone interview with the New York Times, Trump said, this is a political witch hunt. Hope Hicks, 28, the public relations specialist who had been Trump's press secretary during the campaign, was situated in a small 14th-floor conference room in Trump Tower during the transition in early January 2017. She had two qualities important to Trump: loyalty and good looks. She had modeled as a teenager, and now, with perfectly made-up eyes and long brown hair swept back on one side, she had the polished and glamorous look Trump liked. She also had genuine public relations skills. Trump had asked her what job she wanted in the White House. Anxious to avoid the daily hand-to-hand combat with the press, she had picked strategic communications director so she could manage his media opportunities, which were, of course, now endless. She'd been the gatekeeper to his interviews. Everyone wanted Trump, and she felt that he had lost some of his leverage with the media by being overexposed during the campaign. Exploiting those opportunities would now require careful calibration. As well as anyone, she knew that might be impossible with the president-elect. Hicks was convinced the media had oppositional defiance syndrome, which is a term from clinical psychology most often applied to rebellious children. Oppositional defiance syndrome is characterized by excessive anger against authority, vindictiveness, and temper tantrums. As far as she was concerned, that described the press. Hicks was already working on a response to the reports of Russian meddling in the election. The excessive news reporting on what she called the alleged hacking by Russia only made the United States look weak and Russia more influential than she thought possible. On January 6th, the intelligence chiefs came to Trump Tower. Comey met Trump for the first time. In his book, Comey offers a description, perhaps to demonstrate his keen eye. His suit jacket was open and his tie too long, as usual. His face appeared slightly orange, with bright white half-moons under his eyes, where I assumed he placed small tanning goggles, and impressively coiffed bright blonde hair, which upon close inspection looked to be all his. I remember wondering how long it must have taken him in the morning to get that done. As he extended his hand, I made a mental note to check its size. It was smaller than mine, but did not seem unusually so. In the Trump Tower briefing, Clapper summarized the key judgments, the heart of any intelligence assessment. Russia has had a long-standing desire to undermine the U.S.-led liberal democratic order, but in the 2016 presidential election there was a significant escalation in directness, level of activity, and scope of effort. Putin has ordered an influence campaign in 2016 aimed at the U.S. presidential election to undermine public faith in the U.S. democratic process, denigrate Secretary Clinton, and harm her electability and potential presidency. We further assess Putin and the Russian government developed a clear preference for President-elect Trump. When it appeared to Moscow that Secretary Clinton was likely to win the election, the Russian influence campaign began to focus more on undermining her future presidency. It was a mild formulation. Trump was a clear preference, and the effort was aimed very much at discrediting and undermining Clinton. There was no suggestion that Trump or his associates had colluded or coordinated with the Russian effort. All the sources fit together and told a consistent story from different vantages in the Kremlin, Clapper said. These human sources had been so-called legacy sources. They had been right in their intelligence and assessments over the years, and at least one source had provided reliable information going back a generation. What has not been previously reported? One source was in such jeopardy that the CIA wanted to exfiltrate that person from Russia to safety abroad or in the United States. The source refused to leave, apparently out of fear of repercussions against the person's family if the source suddenly left Russia or disappeared. Clapper did not give the source's names to Trump, though he could have asked for them. I don't believe in human sources, Trump replied. These are people who have sold their souls and sold out their country. He wasn't buying. I don't trust human intelligence and these spies. This remark caused Brennan, whose CIA relied almost entirely on human sources, later to remark, I guess I won't tell the employees about that. This has also not been previously reported. The CIA believed they had at least 6 human sources supporting this finding. One person with access to the full top-secret report later told me he believed that only 2 were solid. Trump asked if there was anything more. Well, yes, there is some additional sensitive material, Clapper said. Do you want us to stay or do this alone? Priebus asked Trump. Comey suggested, I was thinking the 2 of us. Just the 2 of us, Trump agreed. Though he could play the tough G-man, Comey somewhat soft-pedaled the summary he had. He explained that there was a dossier with allegations. He was passing it on. It was out there. He didn't want the president-elect to be blindsided because it was in wide circulation, and certainly it, or parts of it, would surface in the media. The dossier alleged that Trump had been with prostitutes in a Moscow hotel in 2013, and the Russians had filmed it. Comey did not mention the allegation in the dossier that Trump had prostitutes urinate on each other on the bed President Obama and Michelle Obama had once used. Comey later wrote, I figured that single detail was not necessary to put him on notice about the material. This whole thing was weird enough. As I spoke, I felt a strange out-of-body experience, as if I were watching myself speak to the new president about prostitutes in Russia. Trump denied the allegations. Did he seem like a guy who needed prostitutes? In A Higher Loyalty, Comey wrote, The FBI was not currently investigating him. This was literally true. We did not have a counterintelligence case file open on him. We really didn't care if he had cavorted with hookers in Moscow, so long as the Russians weren't trying to coerce him in some way. This is what Comey wrote about how he conveyed this message to Trump at the end of their private meeting. As he began to grow more defensive and the conversation teetered toward disaster, on instinct, I pulled the tool from my bag. "We are not investigating you, sir." That seemed to quiet him. The private meeting lasted 5 minutes. Trump later told his attorney that he felt shaken down by Comey with the presentation about the alleged prostitutes in Moscow. "I've got enough problems with Melania and girlfriends and all that. I don't need any more. I can't have Melania hearing about that." After the briefing, Trump released a statement calling the briefing constructive, but he was clearly unswayed by the impact. Attempts by Russia, China, other countries to interfere had had absolutely no effect on the outcome of the election, including the fact that there was no tampering whatsoever with voting machines. 4 days later, January 10th, BuzzFeed published the 35-page dossier online. This was when I read the document. On page 27, it said, "Two knowledgeable St. Petersburg sources claim Republican candidate Trump has paid bribes and engaged in sexual activities there, but key witnesses silenced and evidence hard to obtain." It added, "All direct witnesses to this recently had been silenced, i.e., bribed or coerced to disappear." It made clear there was apparently no path to seek verification. I was surprised, not at the allegations, which might be true, but that the intelligence chiefs, particularly the FBI director, would present any of this to Trump. The core of their presentation on January 6th had been the intelligence community's assessment on Russian election interference. It was a report they felt was one of the most important, well-documented, convincing assessments by the intelligence community in recent times. In Facts and Fears, Clapper called it a landmark product, among the most important ever produced by U.S. intelligence. The CIA, NSA, FBI, and the other intelligence agencies had invested heavily in the intelligence gathering. They had also taken a risk by putting so much sensitive information in one report that could leak or be described. And then, almost as an afterthought, Comey had introduced the dossier as if to say, "By the way, here is this scurrilous, unverified, unsupported footnote with some of the ugliest allegations against you." They wanted the formal assessment to be believed by the president-elect. Why pollute it with the dossier summary? They knew enough about Trump to know it would rile him up. It likely would have riled anyone up. Why would they accompany some of their most serious work with this unverified dossier? The material in the dossier is the sort of stuff that a reporter or the FBI might more than reasonably follow up on, try to track down its origins, even locate some of the sources and see if any confirmation can be found. Clearly, the FBI had an obligation to make this effort, as they later would. But including it, even in scaled-down form, in one of the most important briefings the intelligence chiefs might ever present to a president-elect, made little sense to me. It would be as if I had reported and written one of the most serious, complex stories for the Washington Post that I had ever done, and then provided an appendix of unverified allegations. Oh, by the way, here is a to-do list for further reporting, and we're publishing it. In A Higher Loyalty, published a year later, Comey writes at length about his misgivings about how he was going to handle the dossier before he met with Trump. "I was staying on as FBI director," he wrote. "We knew the information, and the man had to be told. It made complete sense for me to do it. The plan was sensible, if the word applies in the context of talking with a new president about prostitutes in Moscow. Perhaps it may turn out to all be true, but imagine being told that by the FBI director." As Comey continued, "Still, the plan left me deeply uncomfortable. There was a real chance that Donald Trump, politician and hardball dealmaker, would assume I was dangling the prostitute thing over him to jam him, to gain leverage. He might well assume I was pulling a J. Edgar Hoover, because that's what Hoover would do in my shoes." An eyebrow raise didn't quite do this situation justice. it was really going to suck. On January 15th, 5 days before the inauguration, I appeared on Fox News Sunday. I said, "I've lived in this world for 45 years where you get things and people make allegations. That is a garbage document. It never should have been presented as part of an intelligence briefing. Trump's right to be upset about that." The intelligence officials, who are terrific and have done great work, made a mistake here, and when people make mistakes, they should apologize. I said the normal route for such information, as in past administrations, was passing it to the incoming White House counsel. Let the new president's lawyer handle the hot potato. Later that afternoon, Trump tweeted, "Thank you to Bob Woodward, who said, 'That is a garbage document. It never should have been presented. Trump's right to be upset, angry.'" I was not delighted to appear to have taken sides, but I felt strongly that such a document, even in an abbreviated form, really was garbage and should have been handled differently. The episode played a big role in launching Trump's war with the intelligence world, especially the FBI and Comey. Chapter 9. 5 days after taking the oath of office, January 25th, President Trump invited his top advisors and his national security team to the White House for dinner. Mattis, the new Secretary of Defense, presented Trump with plans for a SEAL Team 6 operation against a senior al-Qaeda collaborator in Yemen. He described how several dozen commandos would attack, hoping to capture intelligence, cell phones and laptop computers, and kill the collaborator, one of the few al-Qaeda leaders still alive. It would be the first operation in Yemen in 2 years. It had been considered and delayed by President Obama. The military wanted a moonless night for the attacks, and one was coming up. Bannon had questions about the larger problems in Yemen. The former Navy lieutenant commander wondered why the arms to the rebel Houthis could not be cut off and stopped by sea. Iran was their only ally. "You control the air," Bannon said. "You've got the U.S. Navy and you control the sea. How tough is it?" "It's a big coastline," Mattis replied. "Steve," Trump said impatiently, "these guys, this is what they do. Let them do it." In other words, shut up. Trump signed the order the next day, and the raid was carried out before dawn on Sunday, January 29th. A lot went wrong. During a 50-minute firefight, one SEAL was killed, three wounded. Civilians, including children, were killed. A $75 million Marine MV-22 Osprey made a hard landing, disabling the plane. It had to be destroyed to keep it from falling into the hands of the enemy. Chief Special Warfare Operator William Ryan Owens, 36, from Peoria, Illinois, was the first combat casualty in Trump's presidency. Trump decided to go to Dover, Delaware, to observe the ceremony for the arrival of his body. Ivanka accompanied him. When they arrived at Dover, the commander pulled the president aside. According to what Trump told his senior staff later, the commander said, "I want to prepare you for this, Mr. President. When you walk in, the family is going to come up to you. It will be an experience like no other. You're the commander-in-chief. The respect they show to you and their grieving will be incredible. You'll be there to comfort them. When the plane rolls up, when the flag-draped casket comes down, some of the family are going to lose it, and they will lose it very badly. On the other hand, be prepared to have some people say something inappropriate, even harsh." No one said anything harsh, but there was a definite coldness that the president remembered. "That's a hard one," he said afterward. He was clearly rattled. He let it be known he would make no more trips to Dover. Owens's father, Bill Owens, was at Dover, but he and his wife did not want to meet with Trump. "I'm sorry," Owens told the chaplain. "I don't want to meet the president. I don't want to make a scene about it, but my conscience won't let me talk to him." He later also said, "For 2 years prior, there were no boots on the ground in Yemen. Everything was missiles and drones, because that was not a target worth one American life. Now, all of a sudden, We had to make this grand display. Instead of striking out as Trump had done against the Khans, the Gold Star parents who had appeared at the Democratic convention in 2016, Trump expressed sympathy for Owens' father. "I can understand people saying that," Trump said later. "I'd feel, you know, what's worse? There's nothing worse." Several former Obama administration officials said the operation had been planned months earlier, but they distanced Obama from it, saying he had never approved it. In an interview on Fox the morning of his first joint address to Congress, Trump said the Yemen raid was something his very respected generals were looking at for a long time doing. "And they lost Ryan," he said. Trump invited Karen Owens, Ryan's widow and mother of three young children, to sit in the balcony at the joint address to Congress on February 28th. She sat next to Ivanka. To the congressional audience and 47 million television viewers, the president said, "We are blessed to be joined tonight by Karen Owens. Ryan died as he lived, a warrior and a hero, battling against terrorism and securing our nation." Because the operation was being criticized, Trump added, "I just spoke to General Mattis, who reconfirmed that, and I quote, Ryan was a part of a highly successful raid that generated large amounts of vital intelligence that will lead to many more victories in the future against our enemies. Ryan's legacy is etched into eternity." The president turned to Owens's widow in the balcony and said, "Thank you." Thunderous applause broke out. At first, Karen Owens fought back tears, exhaled, and mouthed, "I love you, baby." The applause continued, and tears began to stream down her face. She stood, joined her hands in apparent prayer, looked up, and mouthed, "I love you." Trump said, "For as the Bible teaches us, there is no greater act of love than to lay down one's life for one's friends. Ryan laid down his life for his friends, for his country, and for our freedom. We will never forget him." The applause and standing ovation from the Congress and the audience lasted nearly 2 minutes. "Ryan is looking down right now," Trump said. "You know that. And he is very happy because I think he just broke a record." Karen Owens smiled and clapped. The president greeted and embraced her in the hallway following the speech. Afterward, when Trump had phone calls with the families of others from the military who had been killed, the White House staff noticed how hard and tough it seemed for him. "He's not that guy," Bannon said. "He's never really been around the military. He's never been around military family. Never been around death." The deaths of parents of small kids struck him particularly hard. That had a big impact on him, and it's seen throughout everything. A staffer who sat in on several calls that Trump made to Gold Star families was struck with how much time and emotional energy Trump devoted to them. He had a copy of material from the deceased service member's personnel file. "I'm looking at his picture. Such a beautiful boy," Trump said in one call to family members. "Where did he grow up? Where did he go to school? Why did he join the service?" "I've got the record here," Trump said. "There are reports here that say how much he was loved. He was a great leader." Some in the Oval Office had copies of the service records. None of what Trump cited was there. He was just making it up. He knew what the families wanted to hear. Whether the international order would have a footing in the new Trump administration was tested in the first month. During the campaign, Trump disparaged the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, the 68-year-old alliance with Europe. NATO is often considered the most successful effort to counter the Soviet Union during the Cold War and a foundation of Western unity. The members pledged collective defense, meaning an attack on one would be considered an attack against all. Trump had argued that NATO might be obsolete. Much of his criticism had to do with money. NATO's goal was for each member nation eventually to spend 2% of its GDP on defense. The United States spent 3.5% of its GDP, while Germany spent only 1.2%. Secretary of Defense Mattis had a speech coming up in Munich, Germany in mid-February, and the administration's NATO policy needed to be settled by then. Was Trump in or out? As a private citizen, Mattis had blasted Trump's anti-NATO ideas as kooky. Much of the foreign policy establishment, as well as European allies, had been unnerved by Trump's comments. Priebus arranged a 6:30 p.m. dinner for Wednesday, February 8th in the Red Room of the residence so Trump could hear arguments from Mattis, chairman of the Joint Chiefs, General Joseph Dunford, and several others. He also invited a pillar of the Washington Republican establishment, C. Boyden Gray. Gray, 73, had most recently been the U.S. ambassador to the European Union for 2 years in the administration of President George W. Bush. He had been legal consigliere to George H.W. Bush during the 8 years Bush had been vice president and 4 years as president. As they sat down to dinner, Trump wanted to gossip about the news of the day. Senator John McCain, displaying his maverick credentials, had publicly criticized the U.S. military raid in Yemen. Trump lashed out, suggesting that McCain had taken the coward's way out of Vietnam as a prisoner of war. He said that, as a Navy pilot during the Vietnam War, McCain, whose father was Admiral John McCain, the Pacific commander, had been offered and taken early release, leaving other POWs behind. "No, Mr. President," Mattis said quickly. "I think you've got it reversed." McCain had turned down early release and been brutally tortured and held 5 years in the Hanoi Hilton. "Oh, okay," Trump said. Gray, who had served 5 years in the Marine Corps, was struck that the secretary corrected the president directly and that Trump, known to bristle when challenged, would be so accepting. It was not until the dessert course that Priebus finally said, "We've really got to deal with the NATO issue." Retired Lieutenant General Keith Kellogg, the National Security Council Chief of Staff, was representing the NSC. A combat veteran of Vietnam with Silver and Bronze Stars and the First Gulf War, Kellogg launched into a critique. Echoing some of Trump's negative language, he said NATO was obsolete and set up after World War II when the United States was richer and facing an aggressive Soviet Union. Now, the cost to the United States was unfair and out of proportion with European allies. The United States was being used. "Those wouldn't be my views, Mr. President," said General Joseph Dunford. "Oh, really?" Trump interjected. "What would your views be?" Dunford, the top military man, offered a spirited defense. "It's an alliance that shouldn't be disbanded, and it would be hard to put it back together," he said. With Eastern European nations such as Poland feeling threatened by Putin's invasions in Crimea and Eastern Ukraine, it was important to maintain solidarity and unity. "It's terribly important to keep Europe united politically, strategically, and economically." He agreed that the member nations should meet their commitment to 2% of their annual GDP. "I think the Germans will make good on their commitment to pay 2% of GDP, and they are the most important," Mattis added. Jared Kushner jumped in. "As a percentage of our own defense budget, the shortfall is really small," he said. "Pennies on the dollar." Priebus cautioned that the 2% was not an obligation, but a recent agreement that all the NATO countries would strive to get there by 2024. This was not a payment to NATO, but a commitment to defense spending. "But it is a political problem when your allies don't pay their fair share," Trump said. He would make his case on fairness, and he kept returning to that theme. Why should the United States pay for the European defense? Priebus realized that the president didn't care that it was a goal, not an obligation. Trump cared that he could sell it and try to win over public opinion. "I don't care if it's a goal or not," Trump finally said. "It's what they should do." Boyden Gray pointed out that Europe had lots of economic problems. "Not that we don't, but theirs are worse. The countries need to grow their economies more. Part of the reason they don't pay is because they're not growing fast enough." "Are you saying they can't pay?" Trump asked. No, Gray said. But the United States should help Europe with their anemic economic growth rate. European business culture largely avoided taking risks. Which is going to be the next country to drop out? Trump asked. Under the Brexit referendum approved by British voters, Great Britain had to leave the European Union. I don't think there will be another country to drop out, Gray replied. Trump said he agreed. If you didn't have NATO, you would have to invent it, Mattis said. There's no way Russia could win a war if they took on NATO. By the end of the dinner, Trump seemed to be persuaded. You can have your NATO, he told Mattis. The administration would support the alliance, but you become the rent collector. Mattis laughed, and then he nodded. In his speech in Munich on February 15th, Secretary Mattis found middle ground. America will meet its responsibilities, he said, but would moderate its commitment if the other NATO countries did not meet theirs. Nonetheless, he said the alliance was a fundamental bedrock of U.S. policy. At a news conference with the NATO Secretary General 2 months later, Trump said, I said it was obsolete. It is no longer obsolete. When Trump met the European leaders in May in Brussels, he castigated NATO countries for chronic underpayments. He said that 23 of the 28 member nations are still not paying what they should be paying and what they're supposed to be paying for their defense. He made it clear that he was addressing the United States domestic audience. This is not fair to the people and taxpayers of the United States. Chapter 10. What the hell, Priebus thought, as he scanned a February 9th story in the Washington Post reporting that National Security Advisor Michael Flynn had discussed sanctions against Russia with the Russian ambassador before Trump was in office. In one of his last acts as president, Obama had imposed sanctions on Russia on December 29th in retaliation for Russian meddling in the election. He expelled 35 suspected Russian spies and ordered the closure of 2 Russian-owned compounds in Maryland and New York believed to be involved in espionage. Priebus had asked Flynn many times about any discussions. Flynn had firmly denied discussing the sanctions with Ambassador Sergei Kislyak, the convivial man about town. 2 weeks earlier, on January 26th, Deputy Attorney General Sally Yates had come to the White House. She told White House counsel Donald McGahn that intercepts showed that Flynn had not been truthful about contacts with Russians and was worried that Flynn could be a blackmail target. Flynn had denied discussing the sanctions at least 10 times, Priebus calculated. The Post story, carrying the bylines of 3 of the paper's experienced intelligence and national security reporters, stated, 9 current and former officials were sources for their categorical assertion. Flynn had been interviewed by the reporters and had denied the allegations with a categorical no twice before backing away with a more fuzzy response. His spokesman was quoted. Flynn couldn't be certain that the topic never came up. Priebus tracked down White House counsel McGahn, 48, who was an expert on campaign finance law and had served 5 years as a Republican-appointed member of the Federal Election Commission. Priebus asked him if they could get the transcripts of the conversations that Flynn had with the Russian ambassador. Yes, McGahn said. Of course. Soon he had the highly classified transcripts of 3 communications between Flynn and Kislyak that the FBI had intercepted during the routine monitoring of the Russian ambassador. McGahn and Priebus were joined by Vice President Pence in the Situation Room to review the transcripts. Pence had backed Flynn's denial publicly. According to a 6-page internal White House counsel's office memo, Flynn said if he and Kislyak discussed sanctions, it was only because Kislyak brought it up. From the transcripts, Flynn had brought up the issue. McGahn and Priebus agree that Flynn has to be let go. In all 3 transcripts, Flynn and the ambassador discussed the sanctions. In the last call, initiated by Kislyak, the ambassador thanked Flynn for his advice on the sanctions and said the Russians would follow it. That nailed the story, and it explained Putin's curiously passive response to the sanctions. Normally, the Russian president would be expected to retaliate, expelling some Americans from Russia. But the day after Obama announced the sanctions, Putin announced he would not. President-elect Trump praised Putin, tweeting, "Great move on delay by V. Putin. I always knew he was very smart." The sequence suggested that Trump might have known of Flynn's role. But it was unclear what Flynn had said to the president about his conversations with Kislyak. Priebus told the president he would have to let Flynn go. Flynn's security clearance might be pulled. The embarrassment would be significant. Flynn's resignation was announced on February 13th. The chief reason offered publicly was that Flynn had lied to Vice President Pence. Trump told others in his administration that he let Flynn go because Flynn was not up to the job. The next 9 months were difficult for Flynn. He later pled guilty to one count of lying to the FBI. Flynn told associates that he didn't think he lied to the FBI when he was interviewed 4 days into the administration. The FBI agents had come to talk to him about matters other than Russia, and he had not believed it was a formal interview. Why did Flynn plead guilty? A range of possible offenses were being investigated, including his failure to report income from Turkey, report overseas contacts, and to register as a lobbyist prior to joining the Trump administration. Flynn told associates that his legal bills were astronomical, as were his son's, who was also being investigated. A one-count guilty plea for lying seemed the only way out. His statement said, "I accept full responsibility for my actions," and said he now had an agreement to cooperate. He denied that he had committed treason, an apparent denial that he had colluded with the Russians. On Saturday, February 25th, after 5 weeks in office, Mattis called a noon meeting at the Secretary of Defense's residence at the old Naval Observatory near the State Department. Attending were some foreign policy graybeards, retired General Anthony Zinni, several former ambassadors, and some Mattis staff. Mattis had almost no furniture. They all sat around what looked like a government-issued dining room table. Mattis said he had showed up with 4 suitcases. "You should see the skiff I have," he said. The sensitive, compartmented information facility for securely discussing the most sensitive, top-secret, and special access programs was upstairs. "I never have to leave. I can do all the work from here." "President Trump is a good listener," Mattis said, "as long as you don't hit one of his third rails. Immigration and the press are the 2 big ones. If you hit one, he is liable to go off on a tangent and not come back for a long time. Secretaries of Defense don't always get to choose the president they work for." Everyone laughed. The subject of the meeting was the counter-ISIS plan that Trump wanted immediately. "Fundamentally," Mattis said, "we are doing things backwards. We are trying to devise a counter-ISIS strategy without any larger, broader Middle East strategy. Ideally, we'd have the Middle East strategy and the ISIS piece would plug in underneath and support it. But the president's tasking required ISIS first." In the end, the combat ISIS strategy was a continuation of the strategy under Obama, but with bombing and other authorities granted to the local commanders. Mattis was worried about Iranian expansion. At one point, he later referred to those idiot raghead mullahs. Early one morning in February, a team of senior intelligence officials came to Priebus's West Wing office to brief him on how to be alert to those who might seek to influence him improperly. It is a standard warning for those with the highest security clearances. "Before we leave," said Deputy FBI Director Andrew McCabe, raising his hand, "I need 5 minutes with you alone in your office." What the hell is this? Thought Priebus. He only recalled McCabe because he had met him several weeks earlier in the Situation Room. Trump had raised hell about McCabe's wife, Jill, a Democrat, during the campaign. She had received $675,288 for an unsuccessful 2015 campaign for the Virginia Senate from Governor Terry McAuliffe's Political Action Committee and the Virginia Democratic Party. McAuliffe was one of Bill and Hillary Clinton's closest personal and political friends. He had been the top fundraiser for Bill Clinton's re-election in 1996. Trump had described the money as donations from Hillary. He had not let go of the issue, talking and tweeting about it later. After the security briefing and everyone cleared out, McCabe shut the door to Priebus's office. "This is very weird," thought Priebus, who was standing by his desk. "You know this story in the New York Times?" Priebus knew it all too well. McCabe was referring to a recent Times story of February 14th that stated, "Phone records and intercepted calls show that members of Donald J. Trump's 2016 presidential campaign and other Trump associates had repeated contacts with senior Russian intelligence officials in the year before the elections, according to four current and former American officials." The story was one of the first bombs to go off about alleged Trump-Russian connections after Flynn's resignation. "It's total bullshit," McCabe said. "It's not true, and we want you to know that. It's grossly overstated." "Oh my God," thought Priebus. "Andrew," he said to the FBI deputy, "I'm getting killed." The story about Russia and election meddling seemed to be running 24/7 on cable news, driving Trump bananas and therefore driving Priebus bananas. "This is crazy," Trump had told Priebus. "We've got to stop it. We need to end the story." McCabe had just walked in with a big gift, a Valentine's Day present. "I'm going to be the hero of this entire West Wing," Priebus thought. "Can you help me?" Priebus asked. "Could this knockdown of the story be made public?" "Call me in a couple of hours," McCabe said. "I will ask around and I'll let you know. I'll see what I can do." Priebus practically ran to report to Trump the good news that the FBI would soon be shooting down the Times story. 2 hours passed and no call from McCabe. Priebus called him. "I'm sorry, I can't," McCabe said. "There's nothing I can do about it. I tried, but if we start issuing comments on individual stories, we'll be doing statements every 3 days." The FBI could not become a clearinghouse for the accuracy of news stories. If the FBI tried to debunk certain stories, a failure to comment could be seen as a confirmation. "Andrew, you're the one that came to my office to tell me this is a BS story, and now you're telling me there's nothing you can do?" McCabe said that was his position. "This is insanity," Priebus said. "What am I supposed to do? Just suffer? Bleed out?" "Give me a couple more hours." Nothing happened. No call from the FBI. Priebus tried to explain to Trump, who was waiting for a recanting. It was another reason for Trump to distrust and hate the FBI, a pernicious tease that left them dangling. About a week later, on February 24th, CNN reported an exclusive. FBI refused White House request to knock down recent Trump-Russia story. Priebus was cast as trying to manipulate the FBI for political purposes. The White House tried and failed to correct the story and show that McCabe had initiated the matter. 4 months later, on June 8th, Comey testified under oath publicly that the original New York Times story on the Trump campaign aide's contacts with senior Russian intelligence officials, in the main, was not true. Chapter 11. Trump needed a new national security advisor, and he wanted to act fast. He said he was getting killed in the media and was convinced a new person would erase the Flynn debacle. Another general, perhaps? Bannon believed the media was Trump's main concern. Everything was through the eyes of, does he look the part? Everything was movies. Dunford and Mattis struck him as Marines because they were men of few words. They got to the point. High on the list was Army Lieutenant General H.R. McMaster, 5'9", bald, green-eyed, barrel-chested, ramrod straight posture, who was the rare combination of war hero and scholar. He had written Dereliction of Duty, Lyndon Johnson, Robert McNamara, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and The Lies That Led to Vietnam. It was a groundbreaking work that indicted military leaders for failing to confront their civilian leaders. McMaster was considered a renegade and an outsider in the Army Club, but no one doubted his bona fides. General McMaster was going to get 2 hours with Trump. Bannon met with him at Mar-a-Lago and offered his usual advice. Don't lecture Trump. He doesn't like professors. He doesn't like intellectuals. Trump was a guy who never went to class, never got the syllabus, never took a note, never went to a lecture. The night before the final, he comes in at midnight from the fraternity house, puts on a pot of coffee, takes your notes, memorizes as much as he can, walks in at 8 in the morning and gets a C. And that's good enough. He's going to be a billionaire. Final advice. Show up in your uniform. McMaster wore a suit. Told you to show up in your uniform, Bannon said. I called around, McMaster replied, and they said it wouldn't be appropriate because I've got my retirement papers in. If he was selected, he would retire and serve as National Security Advisor as a civilian. I got you up here because you're an active duty general, Bannon reminded him. The meeting with Trump did not go well. McMaster talked too much, and the interview was short. Bannon, who sat in on it, later reported, McMaster ran his fucking mouth for all of 20 minutes giving his theories of the world. A fucking Petraeus book guy. In 2007, McMaster had been part of a Baghdad Brains Trust advising General David Petraeus on the Iraq War. After McMaster left, Trump asked, Who was that guy? He wrote a book, didn't he? It said bad things about people? I thought you told me he was in the Army. He is in the Army. He's dressed like a beer salesman, the president said. Bannon, noted for his terrible wardrobe, agreed. He thought McMaster's suit looked like it cost only $200 or maybe only $100. Next to be interviewed was John Bolton, a far-right former UN ambassador. He was a summa cum laude graduate from Yale who supported the Iraq War and promoted regime change in Iran and North Korea. He was a regular on Fox News. He reported an income of $567,000 in 2017 just from Fox. His answers were fine, but Trump did not like his big, bushy mustache. He didn't look the part. Lieutenant General Robert Caslin, the superintendent of West Point, was next up. Before he entered, Trump turned to General Kellogg, the NSC chief of staff, who was sitting in on the interviews. General, what do you think of this guy? Bobby Caslin's the best gunfighter in the Army, Kellogg said. Caslin, who had big ears and wore medals on his uniform up to the top of his shoulder, gave short answers, mostly yes, sir, or no, sir. He was like Clint Eastwood. Trump started pitching him, telling him stories from the campaign. Bannon thought Trump was selling this guy. He thought Caslin was in. That night, Kushner said that all the media loved McMaster, combat veteran, thinker, author. But Trump's got no chemistry with this guy, Bannon reminded him. The chemistry had been there with Caslin, but he was a field general with no Washington experience except a short tour on the joint staff in a junior position. We'll get lit up, Bannon noted. They agreed that McMaster and Bolton should have another round the next day and to invite Caslin to the White House later for a one-on-one lunch. The next day, Bolton came in. He was fine, the same, but still had the mustache. McMaster arrived in his uniform. He looked better, high and tight. There was better chemistry, though not great. Bannon and Kushner told Bolton and McMaster to wait. There would be a decision in the next couple of days. McMaster hung around Mar-a-Lago. You know, we're getting killed with bad stories on the Flynn thing, Trump said. Let's just make a decision. I don't think we can just make a decision, Bannon said. Caslin and McMaster are two serving Army officers. I don't think they've run the traps on this. They had to inform their Army superiors. The Army Chief of Staff, General Mark Milley, said that Caslin would be the best possible pick. They've got jobs, so there's a process. No, 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 Trump said. We're getting killed. Bad stories. The media loves McMaster, Jared said. Because he's a fucking liberal, Bannon said. No offense, he has not been that impressive in this thing. You guys don't have great chemistry. Yeah, but you know, the president said. Get him over here. Bannon retrieved McMaster. The president wants to talk to you. Come on over. What do you think is going to happen? McMaster asked. I think the president may offer you the job. I've got to tell some people. I can't tell the president that I can take it. I've got to tell the army. Just play it by ear, Bannon said. We'll figure it out. That was the Trump way, playing by ear, acting on impulse. Pure Trump. Do you want this job? The president asked McMaster. Yes, sir. You got it, Trump said, and shook McMaster's hand. Get the media. Get the cameras in here. He wanted a picture with his latest general who looked out of central casting. McMaster sat awkwardly on a gold brocade sofa beside the president. A large gold vase holding roses was on the table behind them. I just wanted to announce we've been working all weekend very diligently that General H.R. McMaster will become the National Security Advisor, Trump told reporters. He's a man of tremendous talent and tremendous experience. I'm grateful to you for that opportunity, McMaster said. I look forward to joining the National Security Team and doing everything that I can to advance and protect the interests of the American people. McMaster's shell shock was plain on camera as he shook Trump's hand. I've got to call the Army Chief of Staff, McMaster said to Bannon. Do it, Bannon said. But you've already taken the job. Trump's choice played well. The media saw McMaster was an adult. There would be no more crazies. The president basked in the positive stories. Chapter 12. McMaster knew the biggest national security challenge would be North Korea. It had been on the most difficult list for years. 6 months earlier, on September 9, 2016, President Obama had received unsettling news as he entered the final months of his 8 years. North Korea had detonated a nuclear weapon in an underground test, the fifth in a decade and the largest. Seismic monitors had instantly revealed that the vibrations recorded were not caused by an earthquake. The 5.3 magnitude tremor had been instantaneous and had originated less than a mile within the Earth, measured precisely at the Punggye-ri test site of the 4 previous nuclear detonations. The estimated yield was equivalent to 10 kilotons of TNT, approaching the 15 kilotons of the 1945 Hiroshima bomb. Dispelling any doubt, North Korea's 73-year-old female version of Walter Cronkite, Ri Chun-hee, appeared on state-controlled television to announce the test. She almost always appeared for the big moments. Wearing pink and speaking in a gleeful, soaring voice, she told viewers that the regime had built a better, bigger, and more versatile bomb. The North's Nuclear Weapons Center said the new nuclear bomb could be mounted on a ballistic missile, a disturbing claim, although seriously doubted by U.S. intelligence. To compound the potential North Korean threat, 4 days earlier, the North had launched 3 medium-range ballistic missiles that had flown 1,000 kilometers before dropping in the Sea of Japan, making South Korea and Japan reachable targets. These tests matched an earlier single 1,000-kilometer launch the month before. 3 was not a fluke. Even with his intense desire to avoid a war, Obama decided the time had come to consider whether the North Korean nuclear threat could be eliminated in a surgical military strike. As he prepared to hand over the presidency, he knew he needed to address the North Korea mess head-on. That successor, of course, would almost certainly be Hillary Clinton. He assured his aides in so many words that the American people would do the right thing and elect her. From the outset, President Obama had authorized several Special Access Programs, SAP, the most classified and compartmented operations conducted by the military and intelligence to deter North Korean missiles. One program pinpointed cyber attacks on the command, control, telemetry, and guidance systems before or during a North Korean missile test launch. These high-risk cyber attacks had begun in his first year as president. Their success rate was mixed. Another highly secret operation focused on obtaining North Korean missiles, and a third enabled the United States to detect a North Korean missile launch in 7 seconds. Officials have asked that I not describe the details in order to protect national security operations deemed vital to the interests to the United States. The North Korean threat had not been diminished, and in September 2016, Obama posed a sensitive question to his National Security Council. Was it possible to launch a preemptive military strike supported by cyber attacks on North Korea to take out their nuclear and missile programs? This unfinished business was particularly gnawing for Obama. His predecessors, Bill Clinton and George W. Bush, had addressed but not solved problems that had been mounting for decades. And now the United States had run out of road. The Hermit Kingdom was creating a force that could extend an arc of potential devastating nuclear destruction to the homeland. James Clapper, Obama's Director of National Intelligence, had begun his career commanding a Signals Intelligence Listening Post in Thailand during the Vietnam War. Now 75 years old, bald and bearded with a wide, expressive face, he was the granddaddy of American intelligence, gruff, direct, outspoken, seasoned. Clapper rang the bell loud and clear with Obama. The reporting showed that the new North Korean weapon systems would work in some form. But what threat did they pose? To South Korea? Japan? The United States? How immediate? Was the North just looking for a bargaining chip? The intelligence assessment showed an increasing level of effort, strongly suggesting that Kim Jong-un was building a fighting force of nuclear weapons, or at least he wanted to make it appear that way. Despite the public cartoon that cast him as an unstable madman, sensitive intelligence reporting showed that Kim, now age 34, was a much more effective leader of the North's nuclear weapons and missiles programs than his father, Kim Jong-il, who had ruled for 17 years from 1994 to 2011. The elder Kim had dealt with weapons test failures by ordering the death of the responsible scientists and officials. They were shot. The younger Kim accepted failures in tests, apparently absorbing the practical lesson. Failure is inevitable on the road to success. Under Kim Jong-un, the scientists lived to learn from their mistakes, and the weapons programs improved. Obama tasked the Pentagon and intelligence agencies with examining whether it would be possible to take out all of North Korea's nuclear weapons and related facilities. Could they effectively target all of this? They would need to update the satellite signals and human intelligence. So much was not known or certain. Pakistan, which had nuclear weapons since 1998, had miniaturized their nukes and put them in mines and artillery shells. Did North Korea have that capability? Current intelligence assessments could not answer definitively. The intelligence assessment also showed that a U.S. attack could not wipe out everything the North had. There would be lost targets because they did not know about them, and partial destruction of other targets. The greater Seoul megalopolis was home to approximately 10 million people and went right up to the 2.5-mile-wide demilitarized zone, DMZ, dividing North and South Korea. North Korea had thousands of artillery pieces near the DMZ in caves. In exercises, the North Koreans wheeled the artillery out, practiced shooting, and went back into the caves. This was called shoot and scoot. Could a U.S. attack deal with so many weapons? After a month of study, U.S. intelligence and the Pentagon formally reported to Obama that perhaps 85% of all known nuclear weapons and nuclear weapons facilities could be attacked and destroyed, and that was only the identified ones. Clapper believed the projected success rate would have to be perfect. A single North Korean nuclear weapon detonated in response could mean tens of thousands of casualties in South Korea. Any U.S. attack could also trigger the North's potentially devastating artillery, other conventional weapons, and a ground army of at least 200,000 and many more volunteers. The Pentagon reported that the only way to locate and destroy with complete certainty all components of North Korea's nuclear program was through a ground invasion. A ground invasion would trigger a North Korean response, likely with a nuclear weapon. That was unthinkable to Obama. In his Nobel Peace Prize acceptance speech in 2009, he said, "War promises human tragedy," and "War, at some level, is an expression of human folly." Frustrated and exasperated, he rejected a preemptive strike. It was folly. Informal back-channel diplomacy between the United States and North Korea continued. Former U.S. government officials met with current North Korean officials to keep a dialogue open. These were most often called Track 1.5 meetings. Government-to-government meetings were called Track 1. If both sides were non-government or former officials, these meetings were called Track 2. "We're has-beens, but they're not," in the words of one former U.S. official deeply involved in the Track 1.5 meetings. One meeting had been held recently in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia, with the Vice Foreign Minister of North Korea. Former U.S. negotiator Robert Gallucci said the North Koreans warned him at this meeting, "They will always be a nuclear weapons state." A second Track 1.5 meeting with the head of North Korea's American Affairs Division followed the 2016 election and took place in Geneva. "The North Koreans don't take it seriously," said one former U.S. official, "because they know the U.S. representatives can't propose anything new. But they're probably better than not having the meetings." Trump had a history of public statements about North Korea dating back to an October 1999 Meet the Press appearance. "I would negotiate like crazy," Trump said. In a 2016 campaign speech, he said, "President Obama watches helplessly as North Korea increases its aggression and expands even further with its nuclear reach." In May of 2016, he told Reuters, "I would have no problem speaking to Kim Jong-un." As president in 2017, he called Kim a smart cookie. Without a tenable military option, DNI Clapper thought the U.S. needed to be more realistic. In November 2014, he had gone to North Korea to retrieve two U.S. citizens who had been taken prisoner. From his discussions with North Korean officials, he was convinced that North Korea would not give up their nuclear weapons. Why would they? In exchange for what? North Korea had effectively bought a deterrent. It was real and powerful in its ambiguity. U.S. intelligence was not certain of the capability. He had argued to Obama and the NSC that for the United States to say that denuclearization was a condition for negotiations was not working and would not work. Also, Clapper said, he understood the North Korean desire for a peace treaty to end the Korean War, which had been formally resolved with an armistice in 1953, a truce between the commanders of the militaries involved, not the nations at war. The United States needed to understand how North Korea looked at the situation. The U.S. and South Korea seemed permanently poised, dramatically at times, to attack and to do away with the Kim regime. "There was a single argument he made," Clapper said, "that the North Koreans had not pushed back on during his 2014 visit. The United States," he had argued, "has no permanent enemies. Look," he said, "we had a war with Japan and Germany, but now are friends with both. We had a war with Vietnam, but now we are friends. Clapper had recently visited Vietnam. Even after a full-scale war, peaceful coexistence was possible. Clapper wanted the U.S. to set up an interest section in Pyongyang. This would be an informal channel in which another government with an embassy in the North Korean capital would act as intermediary. It would be less than full diplomatic relations, but it would give the U.S. a base, a place in the capital where they could obtain information and also get information into North Korea. Clapper was a voice in the wilderness. No one agreed. Obama was hard line. North Korea would have to agree to give up its nuclear weapons. Obama, a determined advocate for reducing nuclear weapons worldwide, wanted to turn the clock back. He condemned the North's September 9th nuclear test in a long public statement repeating U.S. policy. To be clear, the United States does not and never will accept North Korea as a nuclear state. The overriding fact, Clapper argued, was that no one really understood what drove Kim Jong-un. No one knows his ignition point, he said. That was the assessment they needed and didn't have. Instead, the analysts debated whether Kim Jong-un was a brilliant, strategic genius manipulating other countries, including the U.S., or an inexperienced, impulsive fool. As the Obama administration fanned through possible options, the discussion turned to the possibility of increasing the cyber attacks on North Korea. Some viewed cyber as the below-the-radar magic wand that might mitigate the North Korean threat. To launch broader cyber attacks effectively, the National Security Agency would have to go through servers that North Korea had in China. The Chinese would detect such an attack and could conclude it was directed at them, potentially unleashing a cataclysmic cyber war. I can't promise you that we can absorb a cyber counterattack, one senior Obama cabinet member told Obama. And that was a big problem. The use of cyber could trigger escalation and set off a round of attacks and counterattacks that could cripple the internet, financial systems like banking and credit cards, power grids, news and other communications systems, potentially bringing the American or even the world economy to its knees. The administration lawyers who had the top security clearances and were involved in the discussion objected strenuously. It was too risky. Little new happened. North Korea's cyber capability had been demonstrated powerfully in a 2014 attack on Sony Pictures Entertainment designed to stop the release of a satirical movie about Kim Jong-un. The movie, a comedy called The Interview, depicted two journalists going to North Korea to assassinate the youthful dictator. Investigators later discovered that North Korean hackers had lurked inside Sony's networks for 3 months, waiting to attack. On November 24th, North Korea took over Sony's computer screens. To maximize shock value, the screens displayed a menacing red skeleton coming at the viewer and the text, "Hacked by #GOP, short for Guardians of Peace," stating, "We've already warned you, and this is just a beginning." North Korean hackers destroyed 70% or more of Sony's computers, including laptops. Employing thousands of hackers, the North was now regularly using cyber programs to steal hundreds of millions of dollars from banks and others on a global scale. 2 days after the election, Obama and Trump met at the White House. The meeting was intended to last for 20 minutes, but it continued for over an hour. "Korea is going to be the biggest, most important thing you've got going," Obama told the president-elect. "It's my biggest headache." Trump told staff later that Obama warned him that North Korea will be your biggest nightmare. One intelligence analyst with vast experience and who also had served in South Korea said, "I'm shocked that the Obama administration closed their eyes and acted like the deaf, mute, and blind monkey on this issue. And now I understand why the Obama team said to Trump that the major problem you have is North Korean nukes. They've been hiding the problem."